Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little later, we're going to take a closer look at an investigation of the FDA, which claims the agency buries evidence of medical fraud and misconduct. But first, since 2011, California has been in the grips of one of the worst droughts in recent history. The drought has been shrinking drinking water reserves, intensifying wildfires, and so far has cost billions of dollars in agricultural losses. But all of that may be just a drop in the bucket, so to speak. Scientists say as we head towards the end of the century, the Southwest and the Plain States may be facing global warming-driven mega-droughts, droughts worse than any drought of the past 1,000 years. The results were published this week in the journal Science Advances. What will they do for water? Jason Smerdon is a co-author on that paper. He's an associate research professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. He joins us in our CUNY New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is a mega drought? What is that?
Yeah, mega droughts are mega because of several characteristics. And so we've characterized these in the past as things that happened toward the end of the first millennium and beginning of the second. And they're mega because they last for a very long time. So these droughts lasted for several decades. And they were also very severe. And they had fairly large spatial extent. So they really affected large regions of the U.S. Western areas.
So we can expect a mega, mega, mega drought from, 2050 to 2100? Is that the projection?
Well, what we did is we actually connected two things, two sources of information. So we use climate models to project the future under different kinds of greenhouse gas emission scenarios. And it's actually, this has been known for more than a decade now, that as a consequence of increasing greenhouse gases, the Western United States is expected to dry. So that's been well known, and that's something that was corroborated by our results in this study. The other thing that we knew was that these mega droughts existed in the past. And so what we did with our data was to say, all right, we know it's going to dry into the future. How does that compare to these past mega droughts? And we looked at this through a statistical analysis. And what we found was surprising for those of us on the study, as well as the scientific community. And looking back on this, the dryness periods into the future in the Southwest and the Great Plains actually look worse than these mega drought periods.
And the upcoming prediction is because of global warming?
It's absolutely because of global warming. So what we do with these climate model projections is to impose changes in greenhouse gases based on assumptions about how the future is going to look. So it's based on assumptions about how the population is going to change, what kind of energy we're going to have, how efficiently we use it, how countries will continue to modernize, et cetera. And so we make assumptions about what those kinds of choices will mean for emission scenarios into the future. We looked at two different scenarios. One, which is a business as usual scenario where greenhouse gases continue to increase through the 21st century, reaching levels over 1,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. Currently, we have about 400 parts per million. And we also looked at another scenario where we sort of peak in our emissions mid-century and then decline through the latter half of the 21st century. But because we're still continuing to emit, of course, CO2 goes up in that scenario as well and reaches upwards of about 650 parts per million relative to present day levels.
Mm-hmm. So what actually physically is going to happen to the weather patterns or the climate to make the climate change like that?
So there are two things that really cause the dryness in these regions. In the Southwest, it's changing precipitation patterns, so reductions in precipitation, as well as the ambient warming, which is on the other side of the supply and demand moisture balance. So reductions in precipitation reduce supply, and then evaporation, because of increasing temperatures, takes more moisture out of the soil. And so in the Southwest, it's both declining precipitation and increasing evaporative demands. In the Great Plains, it's more of a warming-only story. In fact, for some regions of the Great Plains, the precipitation goes up slightly, but the evaporation overwhelms the slight increases in precipitation.
You know, it's always been said that because of global warming, the wet get wetter and the dry get drier. So what's the wet get? Is us here in the east With the snow and everything, we're going to get more precipitation while they get less?
So the east, that's part of the story. So what that is referring to is really the changing circulation patterns in the mm-hmm. atmosphere. And part of that story relates to why the northern part of the Great Plains actually get a little bit more precipitation. But the rest of that story, in addition to the precipitation changes, is the drying as a result of the evaporation. And so that's in some regions, even though it might be a wet region getting wetter, there's also this evaporation that actually swings the state to a drier condition.
Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be a huge water shortage then in these states, one would expect, if they're having trouble with water now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the analogy to really appeal to. So if you think about our vulnerabilities to these kinds of droughts, you don't have to look much farther than what the West has seen over the last 10 or 15 years. Different regions of the West have been in fairly prolonged droughts, and that's meant already huge impacts on our economy, our food supply, our recreation, all of these things that are related to water supplies. Now just imagine those continuing for multiple decades and what that means for the water resources that we have and are already in short supply.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that we've had mega droughts in previous history. They were not due to global warming.
No, that was due to these were droughts that happened as much as 1,000 years ago, and so they were during a warm period of time known as the medieval climate anomaly. Mm-hmm. But they were more associated with natural cycles. Obviously, we weren't emitting the kinds of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere then like we are now. But these droughts did occur, and they've for long been a serious concern about whether or not they could come back.
Mm-hmm. And so you've made the projection. Give us the probability of it happening in 2050, 2100.
Well, so what we did in the paper was to actually look at the probability of a 35-year drought at the end of the 20th century, so 1950 to 2000, and how that probability changed at the end of the 21st century. And if we look in the climate model simulations at the end of the 20th century, the probability is about 10% or less that we would have a 35-year mega drought. By the end of the 21st century, so the latter half, the probability goes above 80% that we would expect to have one of these kinds of droughts.
80%?
80%.
Well, people who are hearing this for the first time, saying 80% chance of having a mega drought by, starting in 2050... they're going to be wondering whether they should move anywhere, I would imagine. If I'm in the bullseye of that drought,
hey,
what do I do?
These personal decisions are up to each of us. But, in terms of the on-the-ground stakeholders in these regions, I think there's some serious questions to ask about how we are going to deal with these kinds of changes coming down the pipeline and what kinds of adaptation strategies we're going to adopt to deal with these mm-hmm. much more significant water shortages.
Because when people talk about mitigating carbon emissions now, you always hear the debate, especially politicians saying, well, it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. I don't want, taxpayers are going to pay for it. But if we don't do something now, we're going to pay for it later, right?
Absolutely. If we don't pay for it now, we're going to pay for it later. And a lot of the economic analyses suggest that paying for it now saves us money in the long term relative to just continuing with business as usual and making the, charging mm-hmm. the expenses required to make these adaptations down the line.
Will there be any signs that the drought is coming first? Will it just creep up on us?
Yeah, that's a statistical question. I mean, what we did was analyze this in a statistical sense, and we didn't do what you're talking about as sort of a time of emergence analysis. Yeah. And that gets a little bit more complicated because it's a matter of extracting a signal from the background noise or variability of the system. What we have done is said that by 2050, it's very likely that the drought conditions through these regions will be associated with climate change and be sending the system in a significantly drier direction than currently we exist in.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Jason Smerdon, who is a co-author of a paper and an associate research professor at Lamont Doherty, talking about a mega drought that is scheduled to happen, according to prediction, about 2050. Is global warming, let's look at what's happening now, talk a bit about that. The current drought in California and Texas, do we attribute that to global warming?
All the research to this point suggests no, it's not something that's attributable to global warming. The best we can say is that these kinds of droughts will become more frequent and more persistent as a consequence of increasing greenhouse gases as we move into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. So that would be making the mistake of pointing to any one thing.
Yeah, this event contribution is difficult. Everybody asks this question, is this the consequence? Well, these events happen independent of our perturbations to the climate. So there's this background variability within a system that's hard to separate out these causes. But we can from these kinds of studies that we've just published say also without a doubt that things are going to get worse and move towards a drier state into the future.
Let's see if I can get a question in quickly. Let's go to Boulder, Colorado. Kurt, hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hey there. Kurt, are you there?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. My phone glitched for a second. I was talking to your screener, so I might have missed the answer to my question. When you asked him about the climate model, or how the scientific basis, you said climate models and plus, and there's a blank there, and I'm guessing it's dendrochronology for the historical record.
All right, let me ask him. That's a nice word for tonight.
So, yeah, Kurt, you're right. So for the background, historical estimates reaching over the last 1,000 years, we use tree ring-derived reconstructions of past drought variability.
Mm-hmm. And that's like the standard way of looking at.
It is one of the standard ways. So, you know, this high-resolution paleoclimatology that people look at over the last several thousand years, tree rings are an important component of that. But these mega droughts are seen in records of lake levels, in things known as speleothems or cave formations that are used to look at these past epochs. So it's a signal that's well expressed in a lot of different records.
What is the definition of when a drought turns into a mega drought? What's the line there?
There's not a hard and fast line, but it's really something that we associate with time. So it's one of these multi-decadal events that happens for decades after decades relative to something that might happen for just 1 or 2 years.
So when you have a mega drought, it could be 2, 3, 4, 5 or more decades. Could this
entire
one go on more than 5 decades? You're projecting 5 decades here?
So we look in the last 50 years, but as long as the CO2 levels remain elevated in the atmosphere, this state of dryness is something to expect. So
this isn't a reversible thing.
It's reversible through our actions if we take action to mitigate the CO2 levels, but it's not reversible in the sense that once the climate is exposed to those levels of CO2, that's how long we'll last.
All right, Jason, thanks for the good news.
My apologies.
Jason Smerdon is Associate Research Professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, and a paper published. Where can we read it if we want to read the paper?
You can find it online. Science Advances in an online journal. It was published yesterday.
There you go. Thanks, Jason, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Ira.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the FDA investigation, some very interesting results from an investigation of fraud at the FDA. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When we report on controversial issues like vaccines, we sometimes hear from callers who say that they want the shots independently tested, independently verified, because they just don't believe what the government tells them. They don't believe the safety trials, the efficacy tests, the doctor recommendations. And, you know, it might be easy to write off these people as just conspiracy theorists, people who don't trust the government and never will. But perhaps there is a kernel of truth to that mistrust. My next guest, a journalism professor, writes at Slate that, quote, the FDA has repeatedly hidden evidence of scientific fraud, not just from the public, but also from its most trusted scientific advisors, even as they were deciding whether or not a new drug should be allowed on the market, unquote. Charles Seif is professor at New York University. The full investigation is published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. And he writes of cases where the Food and Drug Administration uncovered faked X-rays, fabricated data, and unreported amputation. But these revelations, he writes, never saw the light of day. Why not? Why don't the government watchdogs let the public know, alert the journals, the scientists, when something goes wrong? Charles Seif is with us. He's author of Virtual Unreality and, as I say, journalism professor at NYU. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me just read a statement the FDA sent us when we asked them to come on the program to talk with us about it. They declined to provide a spokesperson for our segment, but sent us this statement, quote, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is committed to increasing the transparency of compliance and enforcement activities with the goal of enhancing the public's understanding of the FDA's decisions and fostering industry's understanding of the need for consistent, safe, effective, and high-quality products. They write that they're convening a working group to, quote, further explore transparency issues, unquote. How do you react to that statement?
Well, I'd say that it's good that they're working towards transparency, but it would have helped to come on the show and talk, or perhaps even talk to me. They actually refused to talk to me as well. So I think it's the actions that speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your study. How did you get started? What did you uncover?
Well, I've been interested in follies and foibles of science for a number of years, and I've been looking into pharmaceuticals and the drug industry, and as with any human endeavor, sometimes people fake things. And to their credit, the FDA sends out inspectors to look at clinical trials to see whether they're getting the wool pulled over their eyes. And they find it every so often. So I decided with my class to take a look at some of the documents that come out of these inspections and see whether we could link these to clinical trials in the peer-reviewed literature. And if, in fact, we were able to link them, well, was what the FDA was finding reflected in the peer-reviewed literature? Were anyone saying, oh, well, we see FDA saw that there was some faking in one clinical site. We have to take this data out. And we found that very seldom did that happen. In the vast majority of cases, even when the FDA was finding very serious fraud, including fabrication, adverse events that weren't reported, things like that, in only about 4% of the time was that reflected in the peer-reviewed literature.
So it's 96% of the time they were not telling us about things they found.
That's correct. And that's the of the studies that we were able to link.
Yeah.
Because most of these reports are extremely heavily redacted, we weren't able to figure out which trials or which drugs or which companies were involved in the first place.
Give us an idea of some of the instances of fraud you uncovered. Some were serious, some not so serious.
Yes, it ranges all over the place. And some of the problems might be something with informed consent. And there were a number of cases where the doctors did not get informed consent of the patients. Mm-hmm. And that might not affect the outcome of the study, but that is, to the FDA, serious. On the other end of the spectrum, there's outright fraud. Like there was a case where inspectors found that they were the researchers were supposed to be taking photographs of retinas, and they found that they weren't matching other documents, so that they deduced that these were faked photographs. And so the findings based upon those fake photographs were essentially null. Mm-hmm. There were some grotesque things like an amputated limb that wasn't reported as an adverse event. There was even one case of criminally negligent homicide based upon a faked report. The faked report let the patient into the study. He should never have been in the first place. He got the injection of the drug and died very shortly thereafter. And the researcher went to jail. But none of that is available to doctors unless they know exactly where to look in the legal literature.
So is it a question of what they call transparency? They use that term. Is it a question of being transparent and need to become more transparent?
I think that's part of it. I think that with science in general, any scientific endeavor, the ability to react to a challenge is, okay, here's what I've done, here's what I know, you can take a look at that. And anytime there's secrets, trade secrets or commercial secrets, that gets in the way. And the FDA, and to be fair, there's a lot of money going into pharmaceuticals. There's a lot of commercial interest. There's intellectual property. So not all of this is open. But the FDA seems to react in a way that is extremely afraid of infringing on anything that might be perceived as damaging commercial interests. And the public health part of its mission, which was also in your statement, suffers as a result.
How did they react when you asked them to comment on the things that you found?
Generally, they dodged the questions. I asked some very point-blank things, like there are several instances where I know that something on an FDA label, an FDA-approved label of a drug, is wrong. It is wrong because it's based upon data that were gathered that the FDA knows is fraudulent, and yet it is on the label. I asked them about that. I never got a straight answer.
But they didn't rebut it by saying you are wrong about it.
No, they did not say that.
They didn't, yeah.
They talked around it. They said, we know that there was a problem with this site. We did a review. After all was said and done, we thought that it wasn't clinically significant. And so everything's hunky-dory. without saying, well, this datum is wrong.
Do you think this your investigation in some way vindicates people who don't trust government science? They can now point to your study and say, see, they found that the FDA is not being transparent. Why should we believe what the government says?
Well, that's one of my big fears. I vaccinate my children. I think it's extremely important. I'm angry at the anti-vaccine movement. And I know that a study questioning the transparency and honesty sometimes of scientific imprimatur of science is damaging to that reputation. It does give fuel to the anti-vaccine industry. But I think as any human endeavor, science has to be questionable, that you have to be able to challenge authority. And when the authority is abused, you have to call it out. And in this case, I believe that there were abuses of authority, that the FDA is being very paternalistic and saying, trust us, we know that these drugs are safe and effective, and even kind of deceptive when they say, we know that the studies show it's true, and in fact, that's not the case.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to comment on this. You can also tweet us at SciFry. And so you're fearful that people will condemn all of government research just because of this, all the stuff that you've uncovered. It shouldn't be carried out.
No, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, FDA has done a good job, generally speaking, at keeping us from killing ourselves with all sorts of very toxic chemicals. So they do, by and large, a good job. But these are some significant flaws. And there are problems that are that are emerging in various places that they're very slow to correct. Mm-hmm. For example, right now there is a scandal ongoing that's very big in Europe. Roughly 700 drugs in various dosages are being considered for being pulled from the market because of a big fraud case in India. There are some 40 drugs in the United States that are affected by that same scandal. In Europe, you know every single one of those drugs. They're published on the FDA equivalent website. Here, the FDA is completely silent. They're just not saying a thing. And I think that's damaging because we do need to be able to trust the FDA. And when they're not transparent, we lose that trust.
You think that they should be required, that the FDA should require the scientists, the authors of a research paper to say everything that they know about the research, even if it's damaging to that study?
I do. Generally speaking, I whenever the FDA uncovers fraud, I mean, there should be a mechanism for that to go out there. Mm-hmm. That I think, for example, if they just posted on the clinical trials website where every major clinical trial is registered, just put a link out there, I think that would discharge their duty. I think the journals have a duty. I think the scientists have a duty, too. The scientists, when they come up with a bad inspection, they should be able to tell the journals, look, something happened. You should just mention this in the journal. But that just doesn't happen.
Were you surprised yourself at all the stuff that you uncovered?
I was.
You've been a journalist forever, almost as long as I have, which is forever, you know?
Yeah, no, I knew it was going on. I didn't know that it was this bad and it was this graphic. I mean, when you go through this, and these were the worst of the worst. So I'm not seeing, I mean, this was less than 1% of inspections all told. But it's like Scientists Gone Wild video and going through this. It's very depressing.
And your students, were they equally, must have been just shocked?
They were shocked. They were skeptical when I started class and said, this semester we're going to find some fraud. They didn't think they would find it. And then by the end, they were thinking, oh, where are we going to stop finding fraud?
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Phoenix. William, hi. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi there.
Hey, I just had a quick comment just regarding, I don't want to sound like one of the aforementioned conspiracy theorists. I don't want to spread unscientific attitudes. But just a reminder of how much influence the pharmaceutical drug industry has in the United States. Over 90%, and I think it's well over, like over 95% of the synthetic opioid painkillers that are consumed in the United States. And one of them, I wish I could remember which one, but one of the synthetic opioid painkillers that's really common, literally days before the patent for that drug expired so that generics could be manufactured, it was taken off the market by the FDA for safety reasons because the company that made it had formulated a drug that was almost exactly the same, but it was slightly harder to grind into a powder, ostensibly to reduce the potential for abuse. But that, for such a small change, to give that company so many more years to produce the drug without competition from generics literally within a couple of days before, you know, it would have been allowed to be produced. Mm-hmm. It seems like there are multiple issues with the FDA process.
All right, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I can't speak to that particular example, but there's no question that money and power is corrupting influence on the process of science. And there is a lot of money and power in the pharmaceutical industry. And that's part of the reason why I think that's transparency. That is something of a guard, that if the FDA opens its books, then it's less likely to have that much of an effect.
Mm-hmm. There's a tweet coming in from Bhakti who says, how often does Congress tie the hands of the FDA because they do not want them stepping on the feet of the big drug lobby?
Well, you get pulls in both directions in Congress. Mm-hmm. Congress is not monolithic. In fact, some of the biggest critics of the FDA are in Congress. Like every 5-7 years, like clockwork, there's this big set of hearings after a drug scandal, and Senators Grassley and Joe Barton and a whole bunch of hold up the commissioner's feet to the fire and accuse him of perjury or whatever. And there's reform promised, and maybe there's a few commissions that are convened committees that are convened, but nothing fundamentally changes. There's some interesting legislation that does improve things, like the FDAAA, which was passed in 2007, actually increases transparency. But mm-hmm. I think that there's a regulatory capture issue going on where you've got a regulator that is increasingly drawn into the orbit of the industry that it regulates. And that's a natural thing, but it's very damaging.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. If you just joined us, we're talking with Charles Seif, journalism professor at NYU and author of an investigation published in the journal JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, which talks about the FDA repeatedly hiding evidence of scientific fraud. Where do you go from here? Can you follow this up? I mean, you don't pull any punches in this report. No ifs, no maybes. It's straight down the middle.
Well, I've got a number of Freedom of Information Act requests in which I'm trying to get the information that's missing.
What's missing?
Well, I was able to pick around 600 documents, and we were only able to decipher roughly 100 of them and point them to which studies there are because they're highly redacted. I'm trying to get those redactions removed. If I'm successful, then I will extend this study. If not, I might have to fight to get those redactions in other ways.
Could you find a friend in Congress who could help open that door for you?
That is one possibility. Also, lawsuits are another possibility. And I have sued over FOIA issues before. So I strongly believe that the FDA is wrong legally on this one, and they should be brought to account.
Is it simply that, the easiest situation is that the FDA would give you the documents that you're asking for? And they're not, they say they're not. Aren't they a public agency? They're supposed to have transparency? They'd give you what you ask? You paid for it. We all paid for it.
Yes, but they are bound by the laws of freedom of information. And one of them is if something that is called confidential commercial information mm-hmm. is in a document, it must be redacted. However, confidential commercial information doesn't include something which is just embarrassing or breaking the law. It's a bit of information which the affirmative use of which causes damage to the company by a competitor. So it does not cover the protocols which you find fraud. And the FDA, it depends on their interpretations of their lawyers, but I think that if they were honest with themselves, they would realize that that's not a valid way, a reason to withhold this information.
So you need some white knight to come out of
someplace,
Congress in Washington or someplace, and help you get this stuff a lot easier than having to sue the government.
It would be nice.
All right. Anybody react so far? Have you had any nibbles, people who might want to help you?
I have had some interest with a Freedom of Information lawyer. I've had some whistleblowers contact me and say there's some interesting stuff you should look into. I've had some lawyers, product liability lawyers, saying we're very interested. There's a lot of people who have interest, but I don't know where it's going to go from here.
All right. We'll follow it with you, Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So Charles Seif is author of A Virtual Unreality, professor of journalism at NYU and author of an article in the Journal of American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, and you can read a synopsis of it on the Slate website. Great article there, too, Charles. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
I appreciate it.
We're going to take a break. Coming up, we're going to talk to the playwright behind Broadway's brainy hit Constellations. It's all about how do you watch the multiverse on Broadway. It's done quite interestingly. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners. Take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The love story at the heart of the new Broadway play Constellations starts ordinarily enough. A man named Roland and a woman named Marianne make small talk at a barbecue. But things get weird fast. In one scene, Roland gives Marianne the cold shoulder. "I have a girlfriend," he says. But then right after that, he does the same thing, only this time he's married. Scenes keep repeating over and over again, with just a slight change each time. Could be a changed word or a raised eyebrow or an expression. So what's going on here? Constellations is a boy-meets-girl story, but it is set in the multiverse. Our universe is just one in a sea of alternate universes, and what ultimately happens to Roland and Marianne depends entirely on what universe you're talking about and what universe we're seeing at that time on stage. Constellations premiered in the UK in 2012. It just made the jump to Broadway, where it stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Ruth Wilson. UK playwright Rick Payne wrote Constellations, and he joins me now from his home in London. Welcome to Science Friday, Nick.
Hello.
Hi there. You say Constellations had its origins in a physics documentary, Brian Greene's The Elegant Universe?
Yeah, that's right. I watched his documentary a few years ago and was fascinated and intrigued by it.
And so that set off some wheels in your head.
Yeah, I didn't study physics. I don't have a science background. So everything he was talking about seemed extraordinary and maybe I'd only encountered in science fiction. But to hear someone who's an expert in his field talking about parallel universes and multiverses and how weird it all is, and he was talking about it in a serious, concrete, scientific way, made me think maybe this is worth a bit of exploration.
Hmm. We've actually got a clip from The Elegant Universe. This is Brian Greene introducing the idea of parallel universes.
What we think of as our universe could just be one small part of something much bigger.
There could be entire worlds right next to us, but completely invisible.
I see what you mean. Where does your playwright's brain go when you hear something like that?
Well, you think, I suppose, it's great because it means you don't have to write maybe something linear that works in a naturalistic, straightforward way. So I sort of had to do a bunch of research and met some cosmologists and met some theoretical physicists, and I had to understand what they were talking about, I suppose, so I knew that I could understand when the character speaks that she's talking sense.
Where did the idea come up with to change, you know, recreate the same scene over and over and over again with just a slight change? You know, we're sitting in the audience, we say, hey, wait, we just heard a different word. We just heard a different expression. And where does that idea come from?
Well, I mean, obviously it comes from the theory itself, in that the differences between me and this universe in which we're having this conversation and all the other infinite number of universes where we're also having this conversation. I might be slightly late, I might have been earlier, et cetera, et cetera. But also it comes from having had a few plays on in the UK before Constellations, being in rehearsal. And, you know, part of rehearsing for an actor, part of being on a film set, on a TV show, is in essence you do take after take after take, potentially, of the same scene, of the same moment. And it seemed to me that why not make that explicit in the form of a show? Why not make it compatible, or as compatible as possible for the actor? You know, that's what they do all the time. Why not make that literally what they have to do every night of a show?
And did they catch on? Oh, so this is how we can portray a multiverse.
Yeah, I think, you know, initially it seems like a daunting thing because, as you say, some of the differences in the text line to line are just words that are different. So I think it can seem like a daunting thing. This seems like a lot of stuff we have to learn and it's hardly different. What have you given us? How dare you? But then, you know, after a few weeks of rehearsal, they sort of drill it, I guess, and they get used to it.
Yeah. Introduce us to Roland and Marianne. Who are they?
Sure. Marianne is a cosmologist or a theoretical physicist, depending on which universe you encounter her. And I guess one element of her study, one thing that she's researching, she's an academic, is the idea, you know, as she sort of discusses in the play, that we are part of an infinite number of parallel universes. And this theory of the multiverse has come about because for a long time, relativity and quantum mechanics, two kind of cornerstones of contemporary theoretical physics, have been incompatible. And one way of making them compatible might be that we live in a vast ensemble of universes. And then Roland is a beekeeper who he runs his own business. He's an artisan beekeeper, so he produces delicious honey of varying varieties.
Mm-hmm. And for the uninitiated, what is the multiverse? Where does that idea come from?
Where does it come from? Well, you'd probably have to ask a bona fide physicist. But
what's the multiverse to you then? Yeah.
Well, I think to me, it's, you know, initially I struggled with this idea that there are an infinite number of parallel universes where everything that can happen does happen and is happening virtually simultaneously. And I understood that on a theoretical level, but I wasn't quite sure whether certain physicists or cosmologists who were, you know, supporters of this theory meant that they exist literally. So I spoke to a few and they, you know, and a few of the really hardcore ones said, yeah, you know, I believe there's, for instance, one of them said to me, there's a universe where Buddy Holly is still alive making music, John Lennon's still alive making music. And those universes are as real, and as tangible as this universe.
Because mm-hmm. there is a moment in the play where Marianne gives Roland a little multiverse tutorial, and she talks about everything that can happen, does happen, or will happen. It's all there in the different multiverses, and she does a very good lay explanation of what this is all about.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it doesn't hurt to give the audience a moment where you set out your stall and kind of explain what you're doing. And also partly that was, you know, in terms of the research, I mean, I'm the Roland in that equation. You know, I'm the person going around to all the experts and going, hang on, I don't understand this. Go back. You have to explain that again. Okay, go back. You have to explain that again. So I just thought, I think it's important that an audience get that scene so that they don't ever feel intimidated or, you know, like they're having to catch up with the play. And also it's a, you know, Marianne sort of uses it as a bit of a seduction within the scene. So hopefully it's also funny, you know.
Yeah, well, because, you know, Marianne lays out the idea that everything is already predetermined, right? Everything that can happen does happen or will happen. And Roland's first question is, well, what about free will? Was that your first question too?
A little bit. Once I got the hang of what they were talking about and they were saying, yeah, that everything exists, and that maybe we're in a sort of deterministic universe and I'm only privy to experiencing it bit by bit. Yeah, I mean, eventually I said, so does that mean I'm just kind of a meaningless body within this deterministic universe? And, you know, most of the physicists said, yes, exactly that. You have no free will. You have no agency. Everything's an illusion.
You know, we don't usually hear physicists talking about physics on stage, and we don't usually hear someone who is talking about physics on stage create a sexual moment there because, you know, Marianne's talking about quantum physics. She's talking about general relativity and how they're fundamentally incompatible. And all Roland can say is, that is really sexy, by the way. Sort of sapiosexual is a word for you. Did you?
I mean, I think.
Yeah, tell us what you were thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you can't just have a scene, I suppose, in which the science is explained. You know, the characters within the scene always have to want something from each other. And so, you know, in that moment, Marianne is using the science as a seductive tool, potentially anyway. That's one reading of the scene. But, you know, also, for fear of giving away too much about myself, quite honestly, when I started to think about the ideas, you know, that everything is happening and will continue to happen simultaneously, I sort of thought it is an amazing romantic idea, you know, not necessarily sexual, but I thought, yeah, this is an amazing, amazing idea. And it really blew my mind. And I sort of wanted to try and capture that, you know, the first time I really understood it, it was really thrilling.
Yeah.
And I felt that was an important beat in the story for Roland.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the play, if you will. And this is Marianne responding to Roland's question about free will.
Let's say that ours really is the only universe that exists. There's only one unique me and one unique you. If that were true, then there could only ever really be one choice. But if every possible future exists, then the decisions we do and don't make will determine which of these futures we actually end up experiencing. Imagine rolling a dice 6,000 times.
She seems to find
and
the,
then we,
yeah. She finds the idea of the multiverse comforting, doesn't she?
Yeah, in that universe, she, it leads her to suspect that actually we do have agency, we do have free will, because, you know, everything exists, there's got to be a way of choosing. And then we jump out of that universe and we go to another one where she, you know, immediately contradicts that and says, there is no such thing as free will. The kind of mathematics, the algebra, doesn't require free will, you know.
You know, I didn't realize until we started talking here, having seen the play and understanding that there were different multiverses going on, I heard you say today that she's both a cosmologist and a theoretical physicist, that jumps back and forth. And that explains things that I couldn't understand, but that's clear now about what's happening.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, it's, I hope that there's a version of a universe where people, if they would like to, can see the show a couple of times, and you will find, you know, hopefully in a good way, tiny, minute differences that actually you maybe didn't spot the first time around. So, yeah, there's a sort of smattering of, I guess they call them Easter eggs or something like that, in, you know, when you get a DVD extra. Maybe it's a bit like that. There's a few DVD extras hidden playfully throughout the show.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting point. It seems like science now is finding a rebirth in the arts, in theater, on television, in film. And yours is sort of the latest, you know, following. We have four films in the last year, two that are nominated for Academy Awards having science bases. We have lots of TV shows here in the U.S., The Big Bang Theory, other kinds of shows. Mm. We have on Broadway, you know, we've had a couple of shows now, including yours.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a resurgence of people interested in science, or finding that people really are interested in science and finding its way into the arts?
I mean, I don't know if there's a resurgence, but I would... Yeah, I think there's certainly a desire to tell stories maybe more and more in a kind of non-linear, formally adventurous way. And I think once you get to grips with a lot of these scientific ideas, you know, on particularly on time, I mean, something like Interstellar I adored, and I thought, you know, made time a sort of quite literal antagonist in the film, which was amazing. And I think you, when you scratch the surface of this world, you find out how weird and strange and you know, and there's something, I don't know, almost childlike about how exciting it can be. So I think it's, yeah, it's great if more and more, you know, authors, dramatists are getting interested in the scientific stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. If you just joined us, we're talking about Constellations, which is on Broadway now, talking with playwright Nick Payne. It's going to run through what, March 15th in New York?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And maybe the Sci-Fi bump will get you a little length of time there for other people.
Let's hope so. Maybe for every minute, let's hope maybe they add a week to the run or something, or another 100 people come along. That would be very nice.
Having written Constellations and talking with all these different scientists, are you a believer in the multiverse yourself?
Well, I certainly believe in it insofar as I believe in the theory of it, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. I'm if you if you said, do I absolutely believe there are parallel universes where there are versions of me existing, I might not necessarily believe that at this point. But I think I would probably believe, slightly departing from the theory, but there are other universes and other galaxies and other habitable planets, you know, that exist that have some kind of life or, you know, sustainable species on them. I think I probably believe that, yeah.
You seem to be on a little roll with science. You had a play go up in the UK last year that was inspired by neuroscience?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a play called Incognito, which was sort of about various things, but again, it was a sort of physics or scientific story that I stumbled across when I was researching constellations, actually, that led to the play. I mean, very briefly, it's the guy who performed the autopsy on Albert Einstein at Princeton Hospital after he died, a guy called Thomas Harvey. He actually stole Einstein's brain. He stole the brain and he dissected it into about 200 pieces because he believed that Einstein's brain, given what Einstein achieved and how much of a genius he was, that the brain ought to be studied. And as far as Harvey could tell, there were no plans to study it, so he took it. Some would say illegally, and he, yeah, held on to it his entire life, right up until he died, I think in around 2002. And Harvey studied the brain and sent pieces off the brain all over the world to be studied throughout his entire life.
You brought Brian Greene in to talk with the actors Ruth Wilson and Jake Gyllenhaal. What were they interested to learn about from Brian?
I mean, there are a few things, really. I suppose they wanted to hear Brian's take on the theories and the ideas within the play. You know, they wanted to hear him explain them in a fashion that meant they could understand it. And I guess for Ruth, given she's playing the scientist in the play, she wanted to hear a bit about, you know, Brian's day-to-day life, I guess.
Did you have rules about how you would portray science on stage? Not break the rules of science or to be true to the rules?
I mean, I think, you know, I slightly, for the time being, allow myself to make the distinction between authenticity and accuracy, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, there's a little bit of cheating in that I've possibly smashed a few ideas together that, that, you know, any physicist will tell you, well, they're strictly speaking two slightly different incarnations of the same idea.
Right.
But I think as long as I'm not doing anything, and I really do hope I'm not, I mean that sincerely, damaging any of these ideas or misrepresenting them or misrepresenting the profession, I don't mind being a little bit inaccurate as long as it feels authentic.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Nick, and good luck with the play. We hope it has a long run. Nick Payne wrote Constellations, and he was joining us from the UK, from London in the UK. That's about all the time we have to give you. But before we go, I want to tell all our listeners in the South that we're going to be down in Huntsville, Alabama, at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center on April 21st. We're going to be taping the show with you in our live audience and your questions. Come join us. Tickets are available at WLRH.org. We'll see you in Huntsville on April 21st. That's about all the time we have. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.